Well, this morning, we had the pleasure at home, Renee and Emily and I. This is Emily's birthday, by the way. She was born on Labor Day, so that's pretty cool. We had the pleasure, though, of watching a great blue heron on our pier doing a little hunting, a little fishing off the pier. Last night, we were serenaded with the sounds of, a couple hundred geese as they flew in and landed on the lake right in front of our home, and the honking kind of didn't keep us up, but it was kind of a nice way to go to sleep. And I was thinking about our program today and thought, well, that's something I'm going to be able to share with everybody. We'll be talking about those birds, the great blues and the Canada geese and all of the other birds that you might have questions about with two guests today, Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, one of our guests. The other is Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR's Bureau of Wildlife Management. He works out of Horican Marsh National Wildlife Area. That's a pretty busy, place right now. I'm sure of that. But we're certainly looking forward to hearing from them what they have to say and looking forward to your questions. So give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and with your comments. Noel Cutright, are you there?
I'm here, Larry.
All right. A happy Labor Day to you.
Well, same to you and to all of the listeners out here.
Yeah, and Bill Volkert, are you with us?
I certainly am. Hi, Larry. Hi, Noel.
It's great to have you guys come on. I really appreciate having you. And we had a lot of fun this morning watching a great blue heron fishing off our pier on Lake Monona, and the geese last night honking and coming in to land on the lake right in front. And they kind of honked a little bit last night as we were going to bed. That was a great, great way to go to sleep.
I can't remember too much about last night, but I remember this morning because I got up while it was still dark, before dawn, and was out doing some surveys this morning. So I saw a beautiful sunrise this morning.
Yeah, and said, how about you, Bill?
Well, this is actually an interesting time of year because it's both the migration for birds, so things are starting to move, and some birds have already left, others are passing through the area right now, and as you mentioned with your great blue herons and geese and some of these birds, they're much later migrants, but this is now that post-nesting period. They're long done raising young, they're taking flight, the young have grown their feathers, and we're starting to see that flocking and movement of those birds, and so they're becoming much more visible than they were in midsummer when they were more secretive and tending to their families and young.
What do you think? Did those June floods have a big effect, as talking about nesting now, on the nesting season for our Wisconsin birds?
Well, not overall. No doubt there were some, losses of nests or, families that had to try again. What I noticed here at Horican Marsh, certainly, and this is probably typical of a lot of our wetlands and rivers, with the rising water, there were no doubt nests that were inundated. But it was early enough in the year, birds had plenty of chance to try again. And I noticed even in mid-late June, I could hear the bitterns out here in the marsh calling, which normally they're not that late, but I'm assuming that was a second nesting attempt, trying to arouse the interest of their mate and to try one more time. We also had a very late nesting of black-necked stilt, which is a western bird. We've only had one or two other nesting records, and those have both been at Horican. And that was also very late in the year, here July, early August. They were sitting on the nest with eggs. So some of these birds tried again, basically. Turns out that for ducks, they were able to raise their young successfully, and all of that provided brood water.
Sure.
Another interesting outcome of this is because of so much water in the flooding, the frogs did incredibly well.
Oh.
They not only laid eggs as always, but because of so much water, they're able to disperse in those little tadpoles and probably little predation, and there was just an incredible survivorship of frogs. And that's important because a lot of those are an incredible food base also for so many birds. Here at Horican, the great blue herons and egrets have just been gathering, and especially in the shallower waters where I'm assuming there aren't any minnows, and they're eating frogs.
Okay. Well, we still have a half dozen Baltimore Orioles at our feeder. Are you seeing a lot, Noel?
Yes, I still have Orioles coming in and some youngsters, and they're pretty noisy this time of year.
And
still have hummingbirds coming to the sugar water feeder, and as Bill mentioned, it's a great time to watch some of the young birds accompanying their parents and striking off on their own.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, every one of our lines is filled, so let's go to the phones here. And Maureen in Oshkosh is up first, so let's go to Maureen. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. I actually have two questions.
Okay.
Now, the first one is every spring I fed the goldfinches and hung one of those large mesh sacks out on the tree.
Yeah.
With an egg or seed, and every year I had just dozens of birds, and they'd be fighting to see who would get the first peck of the seed, I guess. This year, I put it out in the spring like usual, and about the middle of June, I noticed that the birds were tapering off to the point where there was hardly any birds coming the rest of the summer. I could hear the birds, I could see them flying around, but they just didn't land on the bag. Maybe one or two here and there for a second or two, and then they take off.
Hmm.
And so I was kind of wondering if you kind of know or might know why.
All right, Noel, what do you think?
The second question I had was, is the cowbird a migratory bird?
Okay. Noel, let's start with you.
Okay, I don't have a real explanation. Sometimes in the past, years ago, there was occasionally a bad batch of Niger that was sold, and for some whatever reason, the birds did not really take to it. I haven't heard of those kind of problems in recent years, so I guess I really have no explanation. They've certainly been coming to. I have plastic feeders with a bag hanging below, and I've certainly had goldfinches around all summer. So all I can suggest is maybe you want to try a different batch of Niger.
Yeah.
And as far as cowbirds go, they are migratory for the most part. We always get a few on the Christmas bird count, so there's always a few around in feedlots or where there's available grain or manure available in the wintertime. But for the most part, cowbirds do, most of them migrate out of Wisconsin for the winter.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And let's see. Let's go to Rick in Milwaukee next. Hi, Rick. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Got
sure.
A hummingbird question.
Okay.
For the past couple of years, we've been pretty fortunate and been able to attract quite a few of the ruby-throated hummingbirds to our sugar water feeder. But this year, it's been way down, and in fact, there were none up until just about 2 weeks ago. And just recently in the past, well, maybe a week and a half, I've seen two or three occasionally coming around. Is there some difference in the migration or some other kind of pattern? We're right along the Milwaukee River, by the way, in the city. So we usually get a pretty good amount of migratory birds coming through.
Yeah. What do you think, Bill?
Well, I've had some other calls from people on hummingbird populations this year, some who are wondering why their birds weren't showing up and others who are saying that they had kind of a banner year. And, you know, these birds are quite territorial, so it could be that just your local neighborhood birds didn't make it back. You said in the last 2-3 weeks you've been seeing them. As I said earlier, for some of the other birds, this is the post-nesting period. You're starting to see a shuffle in the population. They're no longer tied to the nest. They're roaming around, putting on taking advantage of energy and putting on fat for migration. And some of the birds are already starting to move a little bit, at least locally, if not some of the northern birds starting to move out. So the lack of birds in midsummer might have been a very local phenomenon right in your area. See if that doesn't change from year to year.
Yeah. Our guests today, Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, talking with us about the resident and migrant birds that we see here in Wisconsin and elsewhere as well, I'm sure. If you'd like to join in with a question or comment, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And Bill, back to you for a minute. You have some wonderful naturalist programs on fall weekends. I've been fortunate enough to be able to sit in on some of those, and they're wonderful. And I assume you're doing the same thing again this year.
Yes, we are. It's always a chance for those people who find Horicon is just a real draw and who come out here during spring and fall. It provides us an opportunity to meet with them personally, to answer any questions, and through the programs we do, to pick a variety of different themes throughout those seasons of spring and fall, and to give people a little better understanding of the marsh itself, its geological and cultural history, the various kinds of wildlife that are out here, something of their own habits and populations, help to develop a little bit of skills for people to recognize more of the animals out here, and of course, from our point of view, also to share with them our management programs, what it is that we're doing here. So we'll start the 13th and 14th of September, and we'll go through the end of October. It'll be on the weekends. So myself and my assistant will be in those programs. And, of course, there are a number of bird programs. I'll even be doing a little bird banding on one of those weekends. Our schedule's posted on the website so people can take a look at it. And, of course, we always got to talk a little bit about geese, so we'll cover all about their biology and history and management as well as another program.
Pretty hard to avoid that.
Yeah, the question always comes up whether I bring it up first or if somebody else wants to know. And this is a program right now that we've been doing. This is my 24th year at the Marsh. We'll be outside doing those programs, but looks like in November we'll be moving in our new education center, and from there we'll be able to greatly expand the education program services that we have here.
Yeah, that new education center is going to be really nice, isn't it?
It's really starting to shape up now. We should move in, and we're looking at maybe it's about 2 months if everything stays on schedule. It's about a $5 million project. It'll include a large auditorium, two separate classrooms. We have yet to develop the actual exhibit hall. Tremendous view of the Marsh from that front lobby. It's just an incredible view, the way they've angled that building, and a great cathedral ceiling, and a lot of different amenities for the visitors. And the nice thing is that we can then do programs both indoors and outdoors as well as year-round. So it'll really give us a chance to be able to expand what we've been doing here for many years. And for the people who come, it'll be a destination, a place that they can actually aim for on such a large marsh to get their orientation and a start. So basically, I would say next spring is when we should be fully operational. It'll take us this whole winter to really move in and to get settled in. But it's finally coming around.
A big smile on your face.
Oh, yeah. It's a thrill for all of us.
Well, Don in Kakana has a question or comment. Don, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Listen, we're on 29 heading west toward home in the Minneapolis area. We're visiting relatives here in Wisconsin, eastern Wisconsin. I just thought I'd take this opportunity to ask a question that was important. Friday night, just on the outskirts of Wisconsin Rapids, going east, we on Plover Road, no less, or Plover Road, we saw a sandhill crane, my wife and I, with an arrow clean through it, walking around, big yellow arrow.
Oh.
We pulled off the road. We called local police. Apparently, they came over because I talked to them later. Wisconsin Rapids police chased it around, couldn't get it Friday night. And apparently, it was still seen walking around the arrow when it's Saturday afternoon. I called the police yesterday to talk to them. But do you know, is there a wildlife rehabber in that area that could be out after that bird trying to find it instead of the police?
In the Wisconsin Rapids area.
Yeah, it was right. It was right at the outskirts of a very small town, B-I-R-O-N, Byron. And between just on the eastern outskirts of Wisconsin Rapids. In fact, it was the Wisconsin Rapids police who responded.
Okay.
They did say they turned it over to a DNR local guy. I have his name here and a phone number, but of course you can't get a hold of anybody on the holiday weekend like this. But in any case, there is a sandhill crane walking around with a big yellow arrow clean through its breast.
Hmm.
I don't know how it's alive, but it must have missed its heart. Right on the outskirts of Wisconsin Rapids.
Well, first let's address the issue of the wildlife rehabilitator. Noel, do you know of a rehabilitator in the Wisconsin Rapids area?
No, I don't, but there is a website that the DNR has that lists all the wildlife rehabbers in the state. And I know there's one in Marathon County and in Portage County near Custer and one down in Adams County. I think Wisconsin Rapids is in Wood County. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it's in
Wood County, yes. Yeah.
There is one in Nakusa, which is not too far away. That would be in Adams County.
Uh-huh.
But there's none listed for Wood County on the directory, which I'm looking at right now on the DNR's website.
Yeah.
Would this local DNR guy automatically try to connect a wildlife rehabilitator?
Most definitely. All the DNR people out in the districts and regions, they know who the rehabbers are in their area.
Okay.
And if they're able to round up this crane, they'll certainly get it to the right people.
Okay. I know this is maybe inappropriate, but I just thought I'd like to get it out there that this bird is out there, and these kind of things do happen, I guess. And I don't know what kind of people would shoot a bow and arrow through a sandhill crane, but it's done.
Bad.
Well, I think we'd also like to take a close look at that to see if in any way that arrow or any other, witnesses or something might be able to lead us to the perpetrator, because it's obviously not just a kind of a act of vandalism, but it is a wildlife violation.
Yes.
And so that would be another kind of investigation or angle of this. The biggest problem here is not just finding a rehabilitator who has the skills and facilities to take care of the bird, but for such a large, lanky bird, to safely capture it and be able to take it so that we can actually do something to rehabilitate the bird. And that's always a difficult thing. How do you not add additional stress or other damage to a bird like this? And that's going to be a tough one.
Yeah.
And with birds, it's not as easy to say, you certainly can't dart them and put them to sleep. I know the International Crane Foundation was using a laced corn to try to put them down a little bit and be able to mark them and take blood samples. But here's a pretty time-intensive thing, and you got to be very careful in administering any sort of a chemical because these birds, while they're large, very little body weight, and you got to be very close, careful with the dosage.
Yeah.
So that's the tough one, is to get the bird in the first place.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Don. Appreciate it very much. Talking about resident and migrant birds in Wisconsin with Noel Cutright, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, and Bill Volkert, wildlife educator with the DNR's Bureau of Wildlife Management at Horick and Marsh. I'm Larry Mueller. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about birds today with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, Larry Mueller here. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's turn to Madeline now in Burlington. Madeline, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I have a question about a wren and a bluebird.
Okay.
The wren, I have two wren houses, one in a crabapple tree and one on the south side of my house on a pole, which is in full sun. I'm thinking the full sun is too strong, and I the houses were occupied, but I bought a child's umbrella, and I was going to put it over the top of the house in the full sun. Is that necessary?
Well, what do you think, Noel?
I don't think it's necessary. One thing, the houses should not be a dark color because that does have increased the opportunity.
No, these are good houses.
To have too hot. But if it's a neutral color, it's very typical to have bluebird boxes right out in the full sun.
Well, no, this is the wren house.
Wren's the same thing.
Okay.
It should be okay.
And when do I clean the nest out?
Well, I would wait for another month or so.
Okay, so
Before winter comes.
October. And I'm going to put up a bluebird house, it's a nice one. Can that face west? What way should that face?
Well, the typical direction we'd like to place them is southeast.
Southeast?
But a lot of it depends upon what kind of habitat and so forth. It's nice to face it a direction where there's a shrub or some kind of tree or something that the young can fly to once they fledge.
It depends
a little bit on the habitat that you're in, but if you have your complete 360-degree option, I would place it southeast.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Benjamin in Saukville next. Hi, Ben.
Hello, Noel.
Hi, Ben.
How are you doing? I'm a bird club member of River Edge, and you are near River Edge Nature Center in Saukville.
Right.
My question is, I have not seen any pileated woodpeckers lately. But in the last 2 years, I've been in touch with you,
mm-hmm.
And what happened?
Are they numbers dropping, Noel or Bill?
I don't believe so. I think all indications are from the breeding bird surveys here in Wisconsin that the population is increasing about 5% per year. And here in the southeastern Wisconsin, I moved here over 30 years ago. There was one pair of pileated woodpeckers in the county, and that was the Cedarburg Bog in the big beech maple woods there. Now they're being seen throughout the county here and there, actually down in northern Milwaukee County. I hear them routinely every week. Last year they did successfully nest at River Edge Nature Center, and there was a pair around all year, but I don't think the nest site was located. So they're around, but, not in great density, so you just have to be kind of lucky and be in the right place at the right time. But the populations are doing fine.
Yeah, Bill, agree with that?
Well, even as big as that bird is, they're not always easy to find. As Noel said, they've got a pretty big territory, oftentimes in the more mature, dense woods. And even where you've got a good population of them, say across central northern Wisconsin, it's hit and miss whether you're going to find them. So you got to keep your eyes open, and sometimes you just have to get lucky.
Yeah, sometimes. And I was fortunate to get a wood carving, Bob Googie's carving of one of those woodpeckers, pileated woodpecker, and also he also had an ivory bill woodpecker carving, which I got too. So I can look at them every day, at least carvings. Kevin in Platteville, it's your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Say, last spring, I saw out of the corner of my eye in my yard something that at first I thought was a robin, but when I looked closer at it, it was very slightly smaller, very slightly leaner, and it had a gray breast. And I was just wondering, is it possible that catbirds and robins might or can be induced to interbreed?
Hmm.
No.
No, Bill, I don't think so.
No, they're too distantly unrelated to each other.
Okay.
And you have a couple of different mechanisms that keep different species from interbreeding. One is, even for closely related species, like, say, the whole group of ducks, you'll get occasional hybrids, especially with mallards. They're a little more promiscuous. But just that courtship and behavior. So as birds are singing and posturing, looking for a mate, those are signals that have to connect. Then you also have just the distance in terms of the relationship of the birds. It could also be a genetic isolation. They're just so unrelated that even if they ever were even artificially inseminated, just wouldn't produce a fertile egg. And those two are pretty distant relatives. They're both songbirds, but the families are not closely related at all.
Yeah. Any ideas on what the bird might have been? I saw it behaved an awful lot like a robin.
The breast, you say, was gray but not speckled or anything?
That's correct. I saw no speckles at all. I even pulled out my binoculars and looked at it.
And what time of year was this?
Well, I believe it was in the spring, last spring.
In spring. And, you know, that's also a time we do get not only the migration but wandering of birds, so there's occasional opportunity for even birds that don't normally belong here.
Yeah, I know. I pulled out my bird book and birds in North America. I didn't see anything in there like it.
And nothing comes to my mind either on that.
Yeah. I was thinking solitaire, but he said smaller than robin.
Yeah, it was very slightly smaller and leaner.
Well,
we'll roll that around in our brains a little bit.
Okay, thanks for calling, Kevin. Appreciate it. Yeah, I have to think about that one for a bit. Bob in Hartford, in the meantime, you have a question or comment. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm 65 years old, lived in Wisconsin all my life. And as a young man, I would hunt with my dad in Horicon Marsh and other places in Sullivan, Wisconsin. And my memory never remembered ever seeing egrets when I was younger. We had been up to Horicon lately, and an abundance of egrets. What has happened to the migration or the climate to have them come up or be around here in Wisconsin? And the other thing is, a friend of mine was on the Mississippi River near Prairie du Chien, and she had seen, according to her, a brown pelican.
Oh, I tell Bill, maybe this would be a good question for you.
Okay, let me take each of those. You said you came to Horicon Marsh for hunting season. By the time most hunting seasons open up in the fall, great egrets are starting to move out of the area, and particularly some of the later seasons. This is a bird that does not stick around quite as late as the great blue heron, so those birds start to depart. Now, Horicon Marsh, we've had in the past here a very large nesting colony of herons and egrets. This was Four Mile Island, which unfortunately from just overuse, I guess you could say, it was active back in the 1940s, but after 50 years of nesting, the trees were starting to die, and eventually a thunderstorm in 1998 basically blew out the colony.
Mm.
We don't see the egrets in those numbers regularly here during the summer, but all of a sudden in the last month, this is when we start to see them really concentrate on the marsh, and they're coming here to fatten up for migration. As I said very early in the program, frogs seem to be big on the diet, small fish, especially little carp hatchlings or minnows from this summer. That's all food for them.
But
so while Horicon is not a nesting site, it's still critical as far as that annual life cycle of these birds in the post-nesting season. So as far as your pelican goes, brown pelican is a southern bird. They're around the coasts. They tend normally not to come inland. There are, I think, two records for Wisconsin and probably birds that got caught up in winds that got blown up to here off course. White pelicans, however, are on the Mississippi River, and the young ones tend to be a little more dingy gray. Brown pelican is a little less likely, though not entirely impossible, but we've probably only had two, maybe three documented sightings of that bird in Wisconsin.
Wow.
Okay.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Roland in Eau Claire next. Let's see here. We can find the right number. Roland, hi.
Hello. Well, I like to really get my kids involved with nature. And when we lived in Richfield, Minnesota, this is back around 81 or somewhere in there. And one day my kids told me that they came running in and they said that there was a bird that came down and it came right up to them. And I was afraid the kids might hurt the bird, so I went out to look and it was a pigeon. And this pigeon was just friendly and just hanging around us. And it actually, as I remember, it even was able to get up on your hand. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong with this thing. And I was afraid the kids would hurt us. So I picked him up and I tossed him in the air and he took off. And he kind of looped around in a circle, small circle, and he came right back to us again. And so I took him to our apartment, our little backyard area, and the kids were fascinated with it. And he had a band on his foot, so I took the number off the band and called the Nature Center. And they got in touch with somebody, and they looked it up, and they called me back and said that it belonged to a man in Milwaukee. And they checked with it and on it, and here this pigeon was in a race, and from Kansas, and then they told me that there was they got several other calls of a couple other birds had come down, and this guy was making a business trip to Milwaukee in the area there, and so he said that he'd pick all the birds up and take them home to Milwaukee since they weren't flying. And what I learned, I guess, this is what I heard, was that when these birds know that they can't make it, maybe their heart is not right or something, they will come down and look for help. And they actually were seeking help. They came right down to us.
Yeah, well, Noel, you know anything about that?
Recent message on the With Burden Network here about anyone lose a tame banded pigeon? So these things do turn up, and as Roland pointed out, they're very often very tame. And these are our racing pigeons. People would call them homing pigeons, and they are banded. The bands aren't really coordinated like for wild birds, which are coordinated through the federal government. These are bands just put on by the owner to keep track of the birds. And they do get waylaid. They get off course. They lose their way. Some of them get predated on by peregrines and other birds of prey. So it's kind of a tough life out there for them. But it's amazing how good of flyers they are as far as speed goes and being able to find their way home. But birds do put down when they become lost. And, of course, they are going to be tamed because they are used to being around people.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call, Roland. And good story there. Vern in Appleton is up next. Vern, hello to you.
Hello. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. The other day I was sitting out on the back porch, and I just happened to realize I don't see near as many robins or red-winged blackbirds. Now, have they started to move already?
Bill, have the robins and red-winged blackbirds started to move yet?
Well, locally. These are pretty late migrants. And, in fact, I've been seeing some very large flocks that are starting to assemble here at Horicon, and they're using the marsh as an evening roost site. And this is that period again after the nesting season where midsummer you had birds as families, like, say, the robins, spread out across the land, you know, one family in your backyard here, one down the road there, and kind of an even distribution. Now that they're up and moving with all the young, they're starting to form flocks. And so what you'll find is one person will report that, you know, kind of wondering where they all went, and somebody else will tell you they've never seen so darn many. So it's no longer that even distribution across the land. They're flocking, and some of these in some pretty big numbers. And it'll be a while yet before they really depart. So they're moving to where the food's available. Red-winged blackbirds getting into some of the agricultural fields and other places for food, and robins, of course, are looking for a lot of the berries that are ripening at this time of the year. So, yeah, some pretty good-sized flocks are starting to form out there, and it's, you're either going to see none at all or quite a few.
All right. Thanks, Bird, for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, with your questions. We have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty fast at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call, and let's turn to Kathy in Madison next. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was wondering if I could have seen an osprey in my yard.
In Madison.
I'm across the street from the lake in some woods, and a big, big bird landed in my tree and was eating some prey, a mouse or something. But he wasn't, and then he seemed to dive in the neighbor's yard on the ground and get some more prey. My neighbor, who knows the birds very well and has been here a long time, said she thought it's a harrier and she's seen it. But it doesn't look like my picture of a
harrier.
It was really white all along its belly, and it looks more in like my Sibley's picture of an osprey. Could I see an osprey here?
Noel, what do you think?
Well, you can certainly see an osprey in Madison. They're now nesting in Dean County, but to see them dive down to the ground for prey is not typical osprey behavior. They feed almost entirely on fish. Over 90% of their diet is fish that they dive into the water and catch. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to be picking up a mouse or some kind of small rodent or a small bird from your backyard.
Uh-huh.
If it's all white and whitish in the front, I mean, red-tailed hawks, which are the largest buteo, the most common hawk we have around, certainly are white in the front. Cooper's hawks, especially the young birds, are going to be very white in the front also, even though they have some streaking.
Okay.
Those two species would be more likely to have in a backyard situation.
Yeah.
Or the red tail.
Rather than the red tail.
Either Cooper's or the red tail would be much more common. I'm pretty sure it's not going to be an osprey.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. A
couple comments, Larry, on past calls.
Yeah.
My wife just emailed me and suggested for that gray bird, maybe a mockingbird, which is an uncommon bird in Wisconsin. But he didn't mention it being any white in the tail or anything when it flew. But they're definitely a little slimmer and a little bit smaller than a robin, and they definitely would have an all gray front. They occasionally do appear in Wisconsin here and there, and a few of them breed every year. So that might be a possibility. And as far as the great egret, I should mention that is still a threatened species in Wisconsin.
Right.
So even though we see hundreds of great egrets at Horicon this time of year, during the Breeding Bird Atlas, they only nested...
I think there's about 10
different locations,
state,
right. So they're a very uncommon nester in the state. And because of that, and because they're kind of the northern end of their breeding range, they're still a threatened species in the state, even though when you see that the concentration sometimes this time of year at Horicon, you wonder, is this bird still threatened? Well, it is.
Okay. We have Jerry in Jackson on next. So let's go to Jerry here. Jerry, hello.
Hi. I've got a bird at night. It starts crying late in the day toward sundown and cries all night. And I was wondering if it was a nighthawk. It's just a single, it's almost like an eagle cry.
It's kind of a screech?
Or a hawk cry.
Yeah, maybe young great horned owl.
Young great horned owl.
Something like that?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's probably the most common question we had at the state fair this year. We Energies put on, with the Schlitz Audubon Center, put on 3 raptor shows a daily, and that was a very common question from the people in the audience. I have this bird, and it screeches, and...
Well,
I could give it, but I don't
like
think you want to hear it over the phone, but it's probably a great horned owl that's... still hoping for some food to be brought to them by the adults.
Yeah.
Okay. It.
What does it sound like again?
Sort of a high whistle, like a like that, like
yeah,
an eagle. I mean, like a hawk.
It's a very high screech.
No, it's a long, elongated. It goes. Now I did have some owls for several years till my neighbor's tree dropped this winter. And they would be, I could hear them mating with little, you know, sort of a...
That's a little screech owl.
That's a screech owl,
screech
yeah.
Owl. And this doesn't sound like a shriek or anything. It just sounds like a long whistle. I thought it was the kids horsing around about 11 o'clock.
Are you sure it was a bird?
I don't know what else it would be. It seems to sit. And I'll tell you, it's near our house on the side. We have a, you know, like a deck walk. There are these large splatters of white bird dew, so it must be it.
So you've seen some pretty large droppings then from it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Owls and also the herons tend to leave a pretty good splat.
Well, a heron wouldn't be
food.
Up there.
Yeah, right.
No.
Or would it?
Probably an owl.
Okay.
All
thanks.
Right. Def, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And I have an email from Mark in McQuantico directed, I think, at Bill. Now that the windmills have been installed near Horicon, how bad has it been for the bird population? How many birds have been killed? Is it as bad as some have predicted, or was the number of birds that would be killed exaggerated?
Well, we don't really know. Yeah. There are studies that are ongoing at this point. Dr. David Drake at UW-Madison has some of his postgraduate students who are doing the various bird surveys. So they're just getting organized for actual mortality searches and then also the occurrence of birds in the area just to see what's actually there, not so much for the strike, but what might be displaced because of the structure itself being there. So we'll have to see just what, you know, the actual results are. And one of the real problems with trying to determine just what that impact is for wildlife is, first of all, dead animals don't last very long out there. And I recall a study that was done, they were looking at, say, pesticide misuse. You know, if somebody were to over or misapply a pesticide and birds were dying, how soon would you have to get out to actually find the bodies and recognize that, you know, there was some real impact? So they collected dead birds, put them out in agricultural lands, and they found that about 70 to 80% disappeared the first night. And within 3 days, everything was gone. So you end up having researchers that go out several times a week or so and do these occasional surveys. And are you going to be there to actually find them? Secondly, these kinds of mortalities of birds, the fact that, say, something like even with our, you know, picture windows, periodically in a year, a bird may strike it. Well, if you were to go out once a week and just look, you know, are you going to be there the day that happens? When we look at migrant birds, a lot of this is episodic. In other words, you may go through much of the year of hardly any mortality, just like with communication towers.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the night that birds are moving, and especially with low ceiling and just the right conditions out there, big flock is moving and those structures can be an obstacle. Well, how long will we have to watch and be there at the right time to really see not just, you know, one bird here and one there, but what was reported for a communication tower out in Kansas about 3-4 years ago, 10,000 Lapland longspurs in a single night seemed to strike this large communication tower. Anything we put high enough in the air, skyscrapers and so forth, these are all potential obstacles for birds.
I'd like to share some insight, too. I'm very involved in the Blue Sky Greenfield Wind Farm in northeast Fond du Lac County and been doing, I did counts back there in 2005. Now I'm doing point counts and monitoring counts now that the farm is operational. There's 88 turbines there. And as Bill mentioned, we're in the midst also of a fatality study that started back in July and will go through the fall migration. To date, we're finding very few birds, but a number of bats of five different species. And there was a report just came out this week from the University of Calgary researchers showing that there's a drop in pressure as the blades go around, and that may be the cause of the bat mortality versus them striking the blades. And also, as Bill mentioned, we're searching a number of these turbines on a daily basis, and I'm involved in doing some searcher efficiency where we place out carcasses to see how efficient the searchers are that are walking the transects, find them, and we're also putting out, in fact, I was out this morning checking on the 20 bat carcasses I put out yesterday to see how many of them were removed by cats or raccoons or whatever. There were three gone overnight, so 17 of the 20 remain, and I'll be going out daily over the next few days to document how fast these carcasses do disappear so we can make the adjustments on the fatality estimates as we get along in this study. But I think overall I'm on record from a bird standpoint looking at the literature and what we know that a turbine here in Wisconsin will kill 2 to 3 birds a year. And I tell people that every house in Wisconsin kills a bird a year. Some don't kill any, but some kill, you know, double digits. So to place it in some kind of perspective, yes, and as Bill points out, anything that's tall is going to kill some birds, but I just don't think it's going to be a major mortality factor, whereas bats, I think it's definitely going to be more significant.
Oh. Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, one of our guests, the other Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the Department of Natural Resources. He's based in Horicon Marsh. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll go right back to the phones. Our guests today, Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert at Talking Birds with them, and Kyle in Reidsville has a question for you guys. Hi, Kyle.
Hello. Probably pretty straightforward for you, but curious for me. Great horned owls, don't they typically have their mating call in January?
Noel, what do you think?
That's certainly a very active time for great horns because they'll be on eggs in February, so you know, they're definitely going through courtship that time of year.
Well, I think this might be in relationship to the calling that was mentioned earlier, which is the begging of the young that are
right
out now, not the courtship call of the adults.
Okay.
But that was your question?
Yeah, maybe I kind of confused things.
And that's also where Noel mentioned that this question comes up quite a bit because we recognize a lot of these owls with that hooting type call where this begging, that screeching of the young is nothing like it, and that always throws people.
It was it was early morning, probably 5:30 a.m., and it was distinctive.
Well, and those birds can hoot any time of the year, though they're not actively looking for a mate. They may give a, you know, just a contact call or a territorial call anytime throughout the year, but as they're looking for mate, you know, their mate and initiating nesting, it's going to come much more regular and much more vigorous.
Yeah, because I remember last year, 2007, November, the same call,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that was premature as well, or
late. They're warming up.
I get it.
Okay.
Excellent.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You know, a Milwaukee area listener, we go back to that bird that was a little smaller than a robin with a gray chest. A Milwaukee area listener says the mystery bird could possibly be a female eastern towhee. What do you think of that, Bill?
That's another possibility, though there is a contrast between that head and breast. And, well, again, we didn't get any information of, you know, if there's any white in the tail or the sides along, you know, the color along the flank under the wing. You know, this is a problem. We've got about 300 different kinds of birds that might visit Wisconsin. You know, first of all, between Noel and I, there may be among, you know, several different field marks something else that either of us might cue in on. And oftentimes it requires, you know, as far as the description, a number of different characteristics. So, you know, we keep rolling around in our brains here of something that's matching up with just that gray breast and size, but that's a little bit limiting in terms of just what all the possibilities are.
I'd
love to keep hearing them from people, and might yet be something that connects.
Well, maybe Rosella in Fort Atkinson has a question like that, too. Rosella, hi.
Well, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Okay, I've been feeding birds for over 40 years all year long, and this one I have never seen before, and I can't find it in my bird books. I have always had a nice variety of birds, including the cute little red-breasted nuthatch. And anyway, this bird it was just about a month ago that it showed up at my deck feeder. It is about the size of a sparrow, but it had the coloration of a red-breasted nuthatch and a very pretty little bird, But, I mean, it just confuses me, so I hope you can know what it was.
Well, Noel, what do you think?
You're sure it's not a red-breasted nuthatch?
Oh, no, it's too much bigger. And the red-breasted nuthatches usually appear more in the fall, and I've had them through the winter.
There's been a few appearing already this fall.
No, that was the only one. It obviously got lost, I think. I mean, it was the only one here, and I haven't seen it since. It was here for a day, and you know, then it was gone.
You said it looks like a red-breasted nuthatch. Is that the cap and the stripe through the eye?
Right. Mm-hmm. And the red breast and the same coloration
reddish
in the breast.
I was thinking chipping sparrow, but that's
I have chipping sparrows there too,
okay.
But it is much bigger than a chipping sparrow. This is the size of a regular sparrow, you know.
Hmm.
But the coloration of the red-breasted nuthatch.
So a reddish breast, but no stripes in it.
No, no, no. It was not a house finch or anything like that.
I think we'll have to call for help again here.
You also have, you know, the young birds out now, and some oftentimes, you know, some of the immatures don't have that full color of the adults.
Yeah, but
so
yeah, I understand.
Mid-late
that,
summer can
yeah.
be a little bit of a trick when you get some of those juvenile plumages too.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you what, Roselle.
This was only one bird, you know, and then he was there for quite a while. This one day, you know, he was really feeding up, so to speak, and then he was gone, and I haven't seen him since.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, we're going to have to call on our listeners maybe for some suggestions. In the meantime, that's another one for you guys to roll around in your brains while we're talking with others here. Thanks, Rosella. We'll see what we can come up with. And let's see, who's next? Ellie in La Crosse, I think, is up next. So let's go there. Hi.
Hi there. I have a question about wax wings. They'll be coming through. Is there a difference between the regular wax wings and the Bohemian wax wings, the markings, and what do they look for when they come through to eat?
Noel?
Well, wax wings are primarily fruit eaters. I mean, they're certainly going to feed on insects and other invertebrates during the breeding season, and they'll take insects and invertebrates throughout the year, but they're also love crab apples and other fleshy fruits, you know, cherries of different kinds, small cherries, small crab apples. Mountain ash, fruits like such as this. So it's good to have those in your yard if you can. There's definitely a difference between cedar and bohemian. Cedars breed here, and they're kind of nomadic. They can appear at any time during the year or throughout the year, whereas bohemians are really a winter species. They do not breed in Wisconsin, and they're very erratic. Some years it's really, really hard to find a bohemian anywhere in Wisconsin any time during the wintertime. Other winters, they accumulate, especially in the northern third of Wisconsin, in cities like Rhinelander and Eagle River, and feed on crabapples primarily and other, again, fleshy fruits like the crabapple. Bohemian is a little bit larger. They sound a little bit different, more gray in the front. So you can definitely tell them apart. And if you see a flock of cedar wax wings with one bohemian mixed in, you can definitely see that there's one larger bird in there and pick it out.
All right.
The other one, a question I have is bluebirds. The call birds keep taking over the nest, and I'm wondering to prepare next year. When you're talking about the little fledglings need a landing space, how far does that landing space have to be? Maybe my house is too far out in the field before it can get to a place to land the fledglings.
Are you sure they've been taken over by cowbirds or by house sparrows?
They're call birds, yeah.
Well, cowbirds, you know, they won't take over a nest. They're a parasitic species. They do not build a nest. They lay their eggs in the nests of other birds. And they typically will not go into a cavity to lay an egg, even though they occasionally will. They don't typically. They would never take over a nest completely.
Well, why
like
do they sit on it all the time on that bird box? And I'm trying to figure out.
So they sit on it all the time. Do you see them go in?
Well, I never see them go in, no, but the man told me that sold the box. He said, well, that's a call bird egg. So I didn't know.
Like I say, they will occasionally, but typically they will not. And how far you need something in front of the bird or in front of the nest or nest box for the bird to perch in. You know, anything within, you know, 10 to 20 feet is fine. It doesn't have to be very close at all.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. I appreciate it. And Liz in Viroqua, on to you now. Hi, Liz.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I actually saw a mockingbird in my yard for the first time in 45 years, day before yesterday.
Oh.
Terrific.
Now, tell the woman who wondered if it was a mockingbird, it's all gray, it has a long tail, and it has a yellow eye. The female towhee is brown on the head and back, and much smaller than a mockingbird, but mockingbirds are here.
Good to know.
Yeah. I grew up in New Orleans, so I know who they are.
Just a little far north for mockingbird. It'd be in the harder range, but as Noel mentioned earlier, we've got some nesting, and they will wander up here, and some of them will breed.
Well, my dad, who's still in New Orleans, said they're trying to get away from the hurricane.
Actually, speaking of hurricanes, we will occasionally see some of these birds that will pick up on the far outer winds of these big weather systems and can get swept up into Wisconsin. And so as they're just flying around, you know, you look at some of these weather systems, like you see the radar. I mean, some of these things are more than 500 miles across. I'm not talking about birds being right by the eye of the storm, but far off with that large circulation. And you may have that circulation. I could, you know, birds could start flying. They could literally be picked up from, say, northern Arkansas, Missouri, and gather on that. And next thing you know, they're all setting up here. And especially this time of year when they're wandering a little more after the nesting season.
Oh. Birds of Wisconsin and from out of Wisconsin, we're talking about here with our two guests on the Ideas Network. Talking birds now on the Ideas Network, resident and migrant birds here in the state. Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. One of our guests, the other, Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the Department of Natural Resources. He's based in Horicon Marsh National Wildlife Area. Glad to have both them along. Happy to have you listening in. And every one of our lines is filled, so we'll go right to the phones. And Tom in Whitewater, you are up. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I want first two items. One, I want to second what an earlier caller said about change in bird patterns. I'm in Walworth County on Whitewater Lake, been here for about 50 summers. I remember when if a white egret or a blue heron arrived, it was a big deal, and everybody would go look at it. Now we probably have well over 100, and it's just like Canadian geese. They're everywhere. And I know they're ospreys. One picked off a little bluegill right in front of me while I was bass fishing this morning. I'm waiting for wood storks or ibis to arrive next, I guess. And so it's really a comment. What's happening? We even had a white pelican, land on the lake for 3 days, and everybody was watching it, but it took off. So my question or comment, I guess, is to reinforce the curiosity of the earlier caller, what's going on. My second question is really about unintended consequences. What happened near us, there's probably 10,000 acres that the state has bought and flooded, or basically broke up the field tiles. It's flooded. There's probably 5 feet of water. It's a great bird preserve. But the herons and the wood storks, the herons and the
Egrets
leave at night and set up their nests on an island on the lake. This island is probably an acre. Hickories, oaks, tall, it's just perfect. And I counted over 65 bird nests this spring. And the real question is, some of the trees are starting to die out from all the bird poop. And the question is, do we have too much of a good thing?
Well, Bill Volker, we'll turn to you.
Okay, a couple of questions here. When you mentioned about the great blue herons and egrets that you've noticed to be much more common, we do know that from about the 1920s to the 1940s was a low period for those birds. And some of it was actually just outright shooting of birds. In the 1800s was shooting of egrets for the feathers or plumes for adorning ladies' hats, which was fashion at the time. And, of course, was one of the early conservation efforts, which really founded the Audubon Society. What we also saw then, when there was not that protection for birds, and even then when we had poor enforcement of some of the early laws, there were at least perceptions that these fish-eating birds were the ones responsible for declines of panfish and sportfish. And, you know, here people are having poor time fishing and seeing those birds eating fish, and blame them rather than the overfishing by people and humans, not to mention, you know, certainly poor water quality. So those birds have recovered somewhat since that period. And as we mentioned earlier, the egrets were on that northern edge. Now, you said you're down in Walworth County area. The Racine-Kenosha area is actually one of the areas where we do see some egret nesting. And then from, say, Horicon Marsh area up toward Green Bay is another little area where we've got some good wetlands for them. So it's probably a local phenomenon for you to be seeing those birds. And as you mentioned, with flooding several thousand acres, we also created a mecca for those birds. As far as the nesting, we do know that there is what I refer to as a lifespan to heron and egret colonies. Here at Horicon Marsh, it lasted a little over 50 years. They do, you know, eat a lot of very rich food, frogs, fish, and so forth. And with that, the droppings do accumulate among the trees, and it does stress them a little bit. Cormorants seem to just burn out some of these trees, where here we think it's more of the accumulation of the uric acid and changes in soil chemistry that start to stress trees, and it's more the diseases than for the trees that come in. So, yeah, they can, over time, as we might say, poop out their colony. But these birds basically are kind of attuned to being mobile on the land, find a nice isolated area, move in, raise families for maybe several decades even, eventually burn that colony out and then move somewhere else, which also, of course, is important when we think of conservation. It's not just to protect known colonies today, but give them options over the decades and over the centuries, too.
Oh, interesting. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Tom in Mequon, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I had a bird question also. I have a small woods to the north of me, and there's this one bird. It's not very big. It's about 5 inches long and about a 6 or 7 inch wingspan. It's more of a light gray or on the bottom and kind of a darker color on top. The wings, when it flies, are almost like a triangle, where the small one is a tip. But it's real reclusive. It stays in the woods. I've only seen it twice. Once this late this spring, and now early this fall. And it it'll call back and forth during the time that it's here. But it's come out now. It came out a couple nights ago. And when it comes out, it'll come to the edge of the woods and look at you. And as you're calling back and forth to it, it'll fly in a little circle in front of you. It could be maybe a foot in diameter, maybe 2 or 3 foot in diameter. And it'll sit and it'll call some more. And it kind of flutters when it does that, and it makes this little circle. And the sound is kind of like an up, and then down, like a and then and it'll do that for a while, maybe 5 minutes or so. And I was wondering what you might thought that might be.
Noel, what do you think?
I'll take a shot at it and call it an eastern wood peewee, which is a flycatcher species. The size that you describe is about right, and flycatchers very often will kind of give that little flutter. I'm not sure what it is, behavior that they have when they come into a perch, and they definitely have a whistle. It's a bird that's fairly common in deciduous woodlands in Wisconsin during the summertime. They migrate all the way to the tropics for the wintertime. Mm-hmm. But they're still around and still giving a call, and they do have a peewee call that whistle. They have a couple different calls that you can read about or go online and look. But I would look up eastern wood peewee.
Even though it's shy, it'll call to you the first thing in the morning and the last word at night. It's like my little pet, you know. It's such a sweet little sound, you know.
Yeah. Well, look that up and see what you think, Tom.
Eastern peewee, huh?
Yeah.
It's P-E-W-E-E, eastern wood peewee.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Linda in Tomahawk is up next, so let's go to Linda. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Larry. I wanted to comment on the caller about the nuthatch rose-colored breast on a sparrow. I think it's a song sparrow. We had a family of them take up life in our deck this summer, so that's why I think I know what it is.
Yeah, song sparrow?
Well, she mentioned, I asked about a streaked breast, and she said it was not. During the news break, I was thumbing through Field Guide, just seeing if something would connect. Not normally a feeder bird, but Carolina wren is another one that may look a little nuthatch-like. Like the mockingbird, a more southern bird, but we in southern Wisconsin, we have had a number of sightings and irregular nesting, maybe.
I think that's a good suggestion, Bill. They're definitely larger and plumper, and they do have that eye stripe, and they do have that kind of rich brown color in the front.
Yeah. Thanks, Linda.
Need another news break so I can thumb through the Field Guide again.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. All right. Pat in Waterford's up now. Pat, hello.
Hey, I'm really good this morning. I also watched some birds this morning on the river.
Good.
Well, good for you.
We have a red cardinal that is bald-headed. So yeah. He has a very black skin head. And is that common? Is it like our... Is it like men who turn bald, or?
Well, they don't turn bald normally, I don't think, Bill.
It's feather loss. Remember, the cardinal is not migratory. He lives with us year-round, so he needs those feathers to stay warm in the wintertime. And there's perhaps a number of reasons for potential feather loss, and it seems that the top of the head and the back of the head are some of the common places. Feather mites and other types of infections are one possible explanation for that. And I'm a licensed bird bander, so I catch and mark birds. And when I get them close up and in the hand, I tend to see some of these little deformities and things like, say, growths on the toes and so forth that we don't always necessarily see from a bird at a distance. And usually those that come to the feeder, and when we see a significant amount of feather loss, then it does stand out. But, you know, those types of things, life in the wild can be tough. So diseases, infections, and injuries are, you know, it's just part of life out there. And, yeah, it's an unnatural feather loss. He's not going bald. Well, he is going bald, but not as inhuman.
Okay. Right.
And it's not going to hurt the bird outright, but it's like what happens with mange in our wolves and foxes. It's a real problem in winter because he's losing his insulation.
Ah.
So unless he can get rid of that infection or whatever that particular cause happens to be and regrow those feathers, get awful chilly out there for him, and he may have a little bit harder time keep himself warm on those really cold nights.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, well. Well, thank you very much. I just couldn't understand why he had turned bald.
Well, there's your answer, Pat. Thank you for calling. Jean in Ashland, on to you. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I think it was in February or near February. The dog wanted to go out about 3 o'clock in the morning, so I let her out. And then I heard the owls, who cooks for you, in a steady pattern, who cooks for you. And after the first few, there was who cooks for you, who cooks for you, I thought that must be the answer. So I got cold and brought the dog in, but I had listened to 30 calls in a steady pattern. Anyway, I was listening to a radio program shortly after that, and it was out of Homer Glen, Illinois, and the address given was on Will-Cook Road, and it was in a eureka moment. I said, who cooks for you will cook.
Well, I don't know about that. What do you think, Noel? What about that response, that hoo-hoo?
Well, I think it's definitely about making the call, and most people put you all at the end, who cooks for you all.
Yeah. Yep. That's probably right.
I also noticed this time of year you get some of those irregular patterns, and whether that is because of the adult birds that are not really intent on nesting yet, they'll do it more, say, in March, or with the young one who are out there who don't quite have the full song down.
Yeah.
And I've heard that oftentimes sort of irregular patterns among the barred owls, and my assumption is it's probably young ones who don't really have the song down. They've got the voice. They're working on it a little bit. They'll need some practice.
And John in Menominee, Wisconsin, kind of on the bird call business, asks, does Wisconsin have a bird that imitates the sounds of other birds and maybe other animals?
Well, definitely.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely.
There's a family of birds that the scientific name is Mimidae. They're called the Mimics. Catbirds, brown thrashers, and mockingbirds. Catbirds not as much bringing in the sound of other birds. For us, the brown thrasher certainly does. And they seem to have kind of an elaborate call bringing in and adopting the voices of other birds. But it's always the rhythm or pattern, that double repeated pattern. That's how they actually recognize the species. And the mockingbird chattering on and on, mocking all kinds of things out there. And they will incorporate those different bird calls into their vocabulary. So that's rather unusual, but it's the pattern or rhythm that they identify themselves, not like a lot of other birds, the specific voice.
There's a lot of individual variation, too. You have a mockingbird that doesn't have a very big repertoire, and we had one on a Wisconsin Society for Ornithology field trip this year down in Rock County that had the best number of different songs that I've heard on Wisconsin mockingbirds since I've been here.
And as long as we're on imitation, another very common bird is the blue jay, who tends to imitate a variety of hawks. Red-tailed hawks, certainly. I've got them imitating red-shouldered hawks by me, and I have heard them actually do broadwing hawk calls. They're a more simple type of call, not the melodious songs that you hear from the mimics that they'll bring in. But, yeah, they'll pick them up, and whether that's, you know, just for fun, whether we think they're using that to maybe scare other birds from the feeder and then come in and help themselves, no real explanation, but you will hear it. They're pretty good at it, actually.
Tim in Manitowish Waters has a question or comment for you. Tim, hello.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Three quick questions. I'll take my answer off the phone. Number one, have you gentlemen ever been stumped in the field, ID in birds or bird calls? Two, a grouse count up north here. And three, I need a recipe, if it does exist, for just sugar and water because I'm out of hummingbird food. And hummingbirds are plentiful, so I'll wait and listen off air.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Okay, so we got three questions. Do you ever get stumped in the field, either one of you?
Absolutely.
All the time. And, you know, a lot of it is just that you don't have a long enough time or a good enough opportunity to see all of the necessary field marks. And especially when you're getting young birds that are out there, they're ruffled up. They don't always show the clean, complete plumage. You can stare at those for a while, and some of those get a little tough. So, You know, there's oftentimes something you just don't get the kind of view that you like.
And there's some warbler species that can give a pretty good song of a different species, so you're never quite sure, like red starts.
You know, the recipe I use for hummingbird for feeders is a quarter cup of sugar to a cup of water. Is that what you guys use, or?
Yeah, four to one ratio is what I typically use.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So 4-to-1 ratio on the sugar to water for hummingbirds. And then what about grouse? Bill, do you know anything about the grouse situation in the north?
Well, it is a 10-year cycle, and right now the population is slightly on the increase. We're going toward that peak again. And so it's for some unknown reason, it's that 10 years, they go up and they go down. Those are just natural variations. So, yeah, it should become a little bit more common in the woods, and it'll start going down again.
Yeah, so we got a few more years of increase before the crash.
Yeah, and no matter what we do for grouse management, we don't get rid of the cycle. We could certainly make it more suitable to hold more grouse at the peak and try to keep that low trough a little bit higher, but the cycle goes on no matter what.
Frank in Arborvita, your turn. Hi, Frank.
Hi there. Good afternoon, gentlemen. We have an awful lot of hummingbirds on our feeders. I mean, they're just, seems like there's hundreds of them, but that's an exaggeration, of course. Anyway, for the last couple of weeks, and I don't know how long, I do not see any ruby throats. And my question is, do these little guys go into an eclipse plumage like the ducks do, or have the senior members of the family already headed south? Why don't we see any ruby throats?
Well, it's a good question. Noel, what do you think?
Well, I think most, if not all, the adult males have probably moved out of your area, and you're seeing females and young birds of the year, neither of which have the ruby throat.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming when you said it, you've been seeing just large numbers, I'm guessing that's been particularly the last couple of weeks. Again, they're out of the nest, they're moving around, and they seem to have found your backyard.
Yeah. So there you have it, Frank.
They're just somewhere else.
Yep. Yep. Well, the males have gone headed south already, and the rest are getting ready to, I suppose.
Right.
Yep. All right. Thank you for calling. Ann in Randall Lake, your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I had a question about barn owls. We're in extreme southeastern Sheboygan County. We're almost in Ozaukee County, just a few miles from the lake. We have about 20 acres with most of it's planted in prairie grass, the rest we mow. And we'd like to attract barn owls if possible, and I've heard that this was difficult to do. I've done some research online, but I get conflicting stories of whether it's even possible to attract them and how to do it. So I was just wondering if you had any suggestions.
Are you saying barred owls?
Barn.
Barn
as with an N, okay.
With an N, yeah, just for rodent control.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons they're going to be difficult to attract, particularly in Wisconsin, is because there just are so few of them. Barn owl is interesting that it's, we had it on the endangered species list for Wisconsin. We actually tried a recovery program. We tried rearing them and releasing them. It seemed that we did a pretty good job to help Illinois with its population. They seem to go south but not stick around.
Uh-huh.
And here's a bird that actually, it's one of only four species of birds in the world that is found on every continent except Antarctica. So it's got a tremendous worldwide distribution, south of Wisconsin, a good population. And we basically took it off the endangered list mostly because it wasn't worth our time to try to help them. We also think that perhaps what we saw in a decline of the population was sort of an artificial high. In other words, with some of the early farming practices and with a little more spilled grain, you know, the open granaries rather than closed silos and rodents and the old barns, that provided the food source and habitat for them. Now we've got the glass-lined sealed silos, so we don't have the spilled grain and also don't have quite the access in some of these steel buildings for barn owls. And so with that, the shelter and the food may have been artificially high and then a bit of a crash. So trying to attract them up here, you know, it's going to be tough because there's just so few of them in Wisconsin. But otherwise, you know, all across the central and southern U.S. and around the world, they seem to be doing fairly well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. And Mike in Stoughton, your turn now. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I just wanted to relate a story and see if you had any comment on it. But there was a time when we were actually in the Upper Peninsula on top of a good-sized mountain, if you will, and we had heard something that sounded like baby bears. And, well, like fools, we went down to investigate, and as we went down the side of the hill, we noticed that it was birds making this noise, and it seemed to be these nighthawks, a good-sized bird, and they were throttling down out of one of their dives, and they were making a noise that sounded like a baby bear, and that was the only, like, I'm just wondering if anybody else had ever heard that.
What time of the year?
It was in the spring.
That's what I thought.
Yeah,
that's part of their courtship flight.
Was it?
Yeah.
They make that noise not with their mouth, but that's a noise in the feathers. And they have all kinds of, you know, colloquial common names like bull bats and so forth to describe that. But that's typically given in their areas where they are breeding. And you describe on a mountain, it, you know, some open areas, they nest right on the ground, and they will just make those displays, especially in evenings and early mornings.
All right. Thank you very much. And Deb and Madison, you have a quick one?
Yeah. We've got little yellow finches in our backyard that are landing on the Swiss chard and eating away. Are they eating vegetables, or are they looking for little bugs?
They're probably going after the bugs.
Yeah, that'd be my guess.
Yeah, huh? And oftentimes as you grow vegetables, like anything, if you get a pretty good little monoculture going, there's always that chance that you're going to lure in some sort of a pest, and those populations can build up quickly, as any gardener knows. And that's, you know, going to be a food source for the birds. The problem for the gardener is that your pests can grow in numbers pretty quickly, and the birds are more kind of skimming off the surplus. They're not really doing a totally effective control in those situations.
Okay.
But let them help themselves.
Let them help themselves. Thank you very much, Deb, for calling. And Noel and Bill, thank you so much once again. It's been a great pleasure. Again, a happy Labor Day to you, and thank you so much for being with us
today. Well, it's a fast hour and a half. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, we always enjoy it.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, and Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR. Don't forget, Bill will be holding lots of public naturalist programs at Horicon Marsh on fall weekends from September 13th through the end of October. Go on the DNR website and take a look at the schedule. Lots of really interesting things there. And I want to thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.